I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it's 1:35 p.m. on Monday, February 9th, 2026. Present today are Representative Stapp, Representative Moore, Representative Bynum, Representative Hannon, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Galvin, Representative Jimmy, and the three co-chairs, Co-Chair Schragi, Co-Chair Foster, and myself, Co-Chair Josephson. Also present today are House Finance Committee staff, Committee Assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Tallulah-Lastufka, Secretary Bree Wiley, Secretary Leah Frazier. We also have our moderator, Emily Mesh, from the Legislative Information Office. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. In today's meeting, we will hear a presentation on the Medicaid rate review study by the Department of Health and Guidehouse. Just a quick note from your chair about this. This issue is familiar more with folks who sit on the Health Committee, and they'll explain, I think, how this report was commissioned or review study was commissioned. Just to help you recall that our Medicaid expenditure exceeds, I think, $600 million, and it's growing. And they are required, I think, by rule to review the rates from time to time. They'll probably use a word called rebalancing rather than rebasing, and you can ask them about that. So as I said, with us from the department today is Emily Ritchie, Deputy Commissioner, and with us today from Guidehouse is Coy Jones, Project Director, and Claire Payne, Behavioral Health Lead. Deputy Commissioner Ritchie, will you come up with Mr. Jones and Ms. Payne, put your names on the record, and begin your presentation? Or however you wish to do it.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Emily Ritchie, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health, and I will provide a brief introduction and then pass a presentation over to Guidehouse to complete this. So for the committee's awareness, as the committee knows, Alaska's Medicaid program is a joint state-federal program that provides health insurance to low-income Alaskans. As of December 2025, it provided health insurance to over 210,000 Alaskans, or one in four Alaskans. Medicaid provides critical services and is an essential revenue to healthcare providers. It is also a very large budget component, as this committee is aware. So the budget must be carefully managed to ensure the value of the dollars being spent align with the outcomes that we want to see. And fundamentally, that's what we are trying to review through the rate methodology study. When I started in this role in 2022, we were emerging from the pandemic, and we are moving back into business as usual mode. But the effects of the pandemic were very present in the healthcare sector as in other sectors. Inflation was impacting all sectors. Workforce was and remains a critical issue that we hear frequently from both providers and others as a challenge. Behavioral health needs were skyrocketing across the U.S., including Alaska, particularly among our youth. And chronic and acute conditions were beginning to emerge and accelerate in ways that we had not seen before. Legislature was responsive, and you provided increased rates for home and community-based waiver services, and you supported the department as we implemented behavioral health rate increases. But we continued to hear from providers that these increases were not enough and that there were gaps in their ability to meet the needs and provide the services that their population was experiencing. So we needed to consider, is the issue that there's not enough funding, or is it that how our funds are established and how they are paid out may not reflect the realities of the system that we want to see and the outcomes that we want to see? Is the methodology underlying our rate structures, have we got it right? Is the structure right? And how can we be sure that further investment in the Medicaid program aligns with the gaps in our system that we want to close? Again, this is a question that underlies the foundation of our Medicaid rate methodology study. And like everything in Medicaid, our rate structure is very complicated. We have over a dozen different rate methodologies in our Medicaid system. And so to tackle this, we broke the study into two phases. And today, Guidehouse will present on the first phase of that study. We prioritized some of the services where we were hearing the most concern from both our stakeholders and our providers. These include behavioral health services, long-term care services and supports, so think about our home and community-based waiver services, federally qualified health centers, and our transportation services. Other types of rates will be addressed in phase two, which we are building out over the next few months. So work on the first phase started last fall, and final reports for behavioral health and long-term care services were completed in this last fall or early winter, so about a year later. The federally qualified health center reports were just fully finalized at the end of last week, and we are finalizing the transportation report. However, we've shared many of those findings already with stakeholders publicly, and we will be speaking to those today. These studies and recommendations are intended to provide policymakers and appropriators with options and structures to consider when you're evaluating future needs and requests for the Medicaid program. We have asked the contractor Guidehouse to provide fiscal estimates that reflect fiscal year 25, if these were to take effect in fiscal year 25, and the intent is to offer a sense of magnitude of what some of these options would be. There is no expectation from the department that these recommendations be implemented all at once or potentially at all. Again, this depends on discussions that will occur this year and next several years by policymakers and appropriators. But many of the, I think, questions that the rate methodology examines are ones that we have heard from stakeholders. And so we're happy to put some context and some numbers around those discussions so that they can inform some of the future decisions that we have to make. We know that this is especially important given our fiscal situation. And as we work to balance the needs of the healthcare system and Alaskans, along with our fiscal constraints, we hope that you find this useful information to consider as we move forward into the future. And with that, I will pass the discussion over to Guidehouse for the rest of the presentation.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Looks like, is it Mr. Coy?
Yes, that's right.
All right. You look like you're eager.
All right.
So I'm going to give it to you at slide two.
Okay. For the record, my name is Coy Jones. I'm a director at Guidehouse and led the rate evaluation. I'm with my colleague, Claire Payne, who will introduce herself if we need to change our speaking roles. The first thing I want to do in the presentation, understanding that the acronyms in healthcare are somewhat out of control, is just to let you know we do have definitions and common terms. I will try my best not to fall into the alphabet soup myself, but if I do, just note that these are here and available. Deputy Commissioner Ricci did, I think, a very comprehensive job of talking about the nature of our evaluation and what the rationale for putting it together and what we were attempting to do with it. I really just want to stress kind of, from our perspective at Guidehouse, where we do these kinds of evaluations, what was different, distinctive about what the state of Alaska was looking for with this, and it does really kind of impact our scope and the nature of the recommendations that we gave. I want to call out on this slide, really, I think, four very important keywords: comprehensive, actual, standardized, and transparent. And so calling out comprehensive and standardized, one of the things that really distinguished this evaluation from other sort of similar gestures that folks go through in other states is that there really was an ambitious program to look across Medicaid as much as possible at the many methodologies that the state uses. Like Alaska, many states use multiple methodologies, and so it can be pretty cumbersome to kind of look at them together. And so a lot of states look at different programs in different years, and that has its virtues. But one of the things that is missed is an attempt to bring them all together to really standardize the rate methodologies across the programs to make them transparent. And so this was a real opportunity for the state to look in a phase one and a phase two, look at these things together so that where there is a need for uniformity in, say, behavioral health services or for other home and community-based services, there is an opportunity to really kind of implement any changes in a rational way. Another piece, and Chairman Josephson really noted this in his comments, this is an evaluation rather than something we would call a rebase, right? We were given a broad scope in terms of making recommendations on the methodology. We weren't just looking at the services that exist today and saying, well, this is the rate that you need, or following this basic methodology, this is where your new rate should be. We were invited to look at look at the methodologies. Are the methodologies actually are they actually supporting the services, not just that are provided today, but that are needed today? And then also, where could we make recommendations that would establish new needed services or improve the service delivery in current services? So that can be fairly unique. That's a very broad scope. So I just want to point out those things. And so our recommendations do really reflect that broader point of view. Just very quickly noting, who was involved. Well, lots of folks were involved, obviously, but the Alaska Department of Health played a key role, as well as Alaska providers, both tribal and non-tribal providers. And then we also made some very strong efforts to include Alaskans with lived experience, self-advocates, their families, and then kind of broader input from a wide range of stakeholder groups. As was mentioned, we have a phase one and phase two. We're at the point of sort of completing phase one, which focused on four major types of services and programs, and you'll see them on the slide here. We looked closely at behavioral health, what's sometimes called long-term services and supports, federally qualified health centers, and medical transportation broadly, and what's provided through Medicaid. I'll speak a little bit more about each of these so that they're a little more than handles. You see service types and categories, different types of programs that kind of fall within kind of the broader bureaucratic and regulatory constraints of how Medicaid works, but I just want to describe these very simply. So for behavioral health, we're looking at community services, not institutional services with like going to the state hospital or anything, that really everything that's sort of beyond that. And when we call it behavioral health, that includes mental health as well as substance use disorder services. You might hear me slip and say SUD. That just means services for substance use disorders. That runs a broad gamut of services. So there's the services that most people are familiar with. You go get therapy or counseling, sitting down with a professional for 30 minutes or an hour. That's really just the start. The behavioral health services include a wide range of high intensity services where you have a lot of professionals who kind of wrap around and perform and assist with various parts of people with a range of needs. The same is true on the SUD side. So we're looking at anything from therapy services to major almost residential services along the way. You have a similar kind of gamut of services in what we call LTSS. This is really home and community-based services for our elderly and physically disabled population, as well as the developmental disabilities population in Alaska. So two key populations that have different needs, even though there's some significant overlap in the types of services they receive. And calling them home and community-based services, you're looking at things from home-based services like a personal care attendant coming into a person's home, all the way to assisted living and major residential services. So just want to note there that you have really everything other than purely institutional services that fall into this. FQHCs are really a form of health clinic. Does a lot of medical care as well as behavioral health care, really kind of serving needy populations in locations where there's often no other provider. FQHCs sort of all over Alaska. We looked at the prospective payment system as well as the alternative payment system. There's a alternative payment models, various ways to reimburse those facilities. Medical transportation, this is really everything that Medicaid pays for in the world of medical transportation. We're looking at emergency transportation, that's air ambulance, that's ground ambulance, water ambulance in the case of Alaska. And we're also looking at non-emergency medical transportation. So that's everything from taxis to ride shares to public transit to get people to their medical appointments. And then given that can be a massive undertaking in Alaska to get people where they need to go, especially in this state, that also includes accommodations, lodging, and meals. That's not always very clear in medical transportation, but that's a piece of the total package involving involving travel for a recipient. I'll just go very quickly in terms of the stakeholder engagement, but what we we really sought to get input from as many types of stakeholders as we could. Providers are obviously a key part of that, but we also we also met with broader provider and industry associations, with advocacy organizations, labor groups who actually are the practitioners and deliver the services, tribal health organizations and their management offices, and of course self-advocates and families of those with lived experiences. And we used a number of venues to try to get and receive as much information as possible.
Mr. Coit, questions,
sure.
If you're willing, first from Representative Tomaszewski, and then from Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Joseph, through the chair. Thank you to our good folks from the Health Department. So there's been a massive amount of news in Minnesota, fraud. I mean, and you just went through a whole lot of community health, transportation, all this stuff coming to light that there's a massive amount of fraud happening within this category. How are we in the state of Alaska making sure that this does not happen, or has it happened, and who's checking on all these folks that are taking massive amounts of Medicaid funding and different health care funding?
Mr. Jones, now that I have your name right.
That's right.
Please.
Through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski. I think the main way that our study intersects with those sorts of issues that are emerging that I think is important for Alaska is to really understand how services are being delivered and the costs of those services. So one of the things that we really did in this was looking at the costs that are incurred by providers, and so that really gives a sense of what costs are today. That is not itself a program integrity effort, because that really was not a part of our scope, but it did. But it does give a sense of the cost of delivering the service. So obviously, that will line up importantly with the budget. And I don't know if perhaps you'd like to speak to that,
Deputy Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski. For the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. We do have a program integrity unit that also works with a Medicaid fraud unit in the Department of Law. The two work together. You may have seen in the news there's been increasing activity as far as us really trying to be forward and pursue kind of publicizing some of the program integrity efforts that are underway right now. One of the items that I took away from this study is that there are different ways how we pay reflects how people provide services. And there are some areas where we need to make adjustments into how our rates are structured, because we may have a rate that provides payments on a 15-minute basis. And that incentivizes people to bill 15 minutes, 15 minutes, 15 minutes, 15 minutes, right? That drives up the cost, and you're not necessarily getting better services. We could look at establishing a daily rate, and that provides almost a limit and an incentive for those services to occur in a different fashion. So I don't know that that directly addresses your question, but I think those are some of the things we've asked Guidehouse to look at, again, to make sure that what we're paying for reflects the services that we want to see back from providers.
Yeah, follow-up.
Follow-up.
Somewhat answers my question. I guess it's those that I see that are not even providing services, right? They're just outright fraudulent, turning in receipts, or I don't know how they do it exactly, but just outright fraudulent organizations on transportation, not even providing services. How do we make sure that that's not happening?
Deputy Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, Emily Ricci, Department of Health, for the record. I would be happy to update the committee with an outline from our program integrity unit for how we look at both unusual behavior or billings in the Medicaid system combined with our routine program integrity kind of random analysis and audits.
Okay, thank you.
I'm recalling that a former colleague of mine, one of the toughest state prosecutors around, Jay Fayette, who led the homicide unit essentially for years, was selected to run the Medicaid fraud unit for the Division of the criminal division. So we do prosecute folks, do we not?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Let's finish with slide 7. We have a question on slide 8. Are we where?
Oh, we are. Well, sorry, we are finished with slide 7.
All right. At slide 8, Representative Galvin.
Thank you. I presume this represents then what you just described, which is where you are doing your focus areas. And I guess my question is on the choosing of these, the selection. I see that the North Slope's completely not really represented here. And then down in the area on, I guess in southeast, well, really more curious about Port Hyden, where there wasn't a choice for the hub community of an Alaska or Dutch Harbor. I'm just curious to know if there was a thinking around that. And in your answer, I hope you will also include something that I heard about, which is the transportation piece of Medicaid that you brought up. I've heard, and I might be completely wrong, but under medical transportation, that if you are charging for the service, it's only when the patient is in the helicopter or the ambulance or what have you. And if that's true, then that must really skew Alaska's rates. And so if you could comment on that, particularly, like I said, in light of the very far away communities like Utiaqvik that might need, you know, if they're going to have to pay for the all of the gas going up and then only get payment from or reimbursed for the way back, that must be skewed somehow. And I just hope that you would comment on that.
Sure. Mr. Jones.
Through the chair to Representative Galvin. I'll first comment just kind of what was the nature of the strategy with stakeholder engagement and why we were where we were and why we were not where we were not. Our strategy generally, I'll say what motivated. First, we wanted to talk to as many people as possible. And I think that explains why we're in Anchorage, why we're in Fairbanks, why we're in Juneau. That's where a lot of the population is. It's where we can speak to a lot of the organizations. But another very important point for us was to visit all of the major regions in the state. So depending on how you categorize those are five or six, right? So you'll see that we're in five or six, that wasn't just to check off the boxes. It's very important. Kotzebue is isolated, so is southeastern Alaska. They're isolated in very different ways, very different kind of cultural, logistical, demographic constraints and characteristics, and we wanted to be on the ground to be able to see those differences and note those differences. And I think another important motivator for us was to have an important, I think, demographic cross section. So we're interested in urban communities because that's where a lot of the populations are. Understanding basically how the hub and spoke model works in Alaska, we really want to visit the rural hub communities as well, and that shows why we're in Kotzebue and Bethel, Dillingham. There's another layer of that, which is the villages, right? And that's Port Hyden is our single village representative there. That my sense is that a lot of folks don't go to the village level because it's, as we learned, it's very hard to get to the villages. And it was extremely instructive for us just getting transportation to a village. And Port Hyden was actually the second option. But the first option, we were not able to travel there because the weather was too bad. Very important lesson learned. I do want to note with visiting the villages in particular, because I don't want to overstress, wow, these are places are really small, and I thought Bethel was remote. Port Hyden's really remote. That's all true, and I think that was a valuable lesson for many of us coming from the lower 48. But I do want to stress with the villages, what we learned there is the villages have a unique perspective that is not the same perspective as even the rural hub communities, right? They are served by providers that are based in the rural hub communities, but their perception of their needs is often different than both the vantage point in Anchorage or in the rural hub communities. And so, I mean, if we had more time and more resources, I would have loved to have visited more villages in particular, because even sort of our single sample, it gave us a whole other dimension. I would also really like to have visited the North Slope a little bit more. We simply just had to make a choice with the constraints that we had, but we note that Kotzebue is not necessarily the only or best representative of what's, you know, a very massive area just in the northern part of Alaska. So that's my response to kind of the first part of your question. In terms of the second part of your the question, which is all these things that go into transportation that's not covered in Medicaid policy. It is unfortunate, but as somebody who works on Medicaid rates, I understand why that policy is there. But it's not really just a state policy. This is how the Medicaid program works in the federal-state partnership, and honestly, this is a program that arose to cover medical costs, and transportation in most states is fairly peripheral to the medical needs, and so the rules are built for providing medical services. So you don't pay for anything that's not sort of directly related or doesn't require actual medical services to be delivered. And so that's a constraint on the transportation side, right? So if people don't get to their location or somebody's waiting and it's not time actual transportation, you don't get to just pile that in or bill for it separately. And so, noting that that's a complexity in Medicaid, part of our role is to figure out, well, a provider's still incurring costs for that, right? And so you need a rate that will adequately account for the fact that there's a lot of, you know, uncliented minutes, right, that go in a ground transportation or air transportation. A plane may go but have to turn back, and it never completes. That's still a cost, but you can't bill for it. And so part of the methodology that we use for these types of services is to account for unbillable time and the cost that's incurred for that.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. My first question is pretty specific, which is on this page you use the term in the very last bullet, across all four work streams. Is work streams the same as service categories?
Those are equivalent to what you saw on the previous slide. That's our more internal jargon. We had four work streams. So we had slightly different teams working on all four of these programs.
And then a follow-up.
Representative Hannon for Mr. Jones.
Kind of globally, because I don't know anything about Guidehouse, so could you just briefly tell us who you are, whether you've worked for our Department of Health before? Is this a one-off? You do this every day of the week for all 50 states, or did we swipe right on Tinder to find you?
Sure. Through the chair to Representative Hannon. That's a great question, and I'm probably a bad consultant by not talking about all we do at Guidehouse right off the bat. But we are a national firm. We work in healthcare as well as really other areas of state and state and federal government, as well as the private sector. We do have a particular focus in healthcare, and the practice that I'm in is state and local government and state health in particular. So we do this in many states. Personally, in my career, I have worked in Alaska before, but this is and Guidehouse has had some experience with Alaska, but it's been not within the last 5 years. So this is kind of our first return to Alaska in a while. But I've had several projects with Alaska, so we weren't completely unfamiliar with what we were getting into. And these rate evaluations are something we do really across the United States. We don't rely In the case of Alaska, we don't lean too heavily on what we've done in the lower 48, because there are some very unique issues and challenges that we don't bring out of the box solutions for. But in some contexts, the national experience is helpful, because we can talk about what the benchmarks are and the expectations in other states. I think that will show up when we talk about indirect costs, for example, or just just talking about transportation, what it's like for other states. Those were useful illustrations for us.
Right. One more. Representative
Thank
Hannon.
You. And I apologize because I just don't spend much time in the healthcare realm. At the beginning, when you were looking at rate evaluation, and you talk about rate structures versus rate methodologies, and we're spending a lot of time talking about methodologies. Is the methodology produces a rate structure at the end, or are they, again, these are terms that are interchangeable? Just so I understand, when you're talking about methodology at the end, does that produce a rate structure that we should follow?
Right.
Mr. Jones.
Through the chair.
Perhaps an example.
One example is your methodology will generally define where your rate lands. So it structures the rate. However, there's also a rate structure that is not decided by the methodology, which is what services does the state want to deliver, right? And so a rate structure will be fitted to those services in order to figure out how to pay for those services. Do you want to pay for them separately? Do you want to pay for them apart? So that's usually how we're using slightly different terms for rate structure versus rate methodology.
Let's go to slide 9.
I'll speak very briefly to this slide because this really just talks about our methodology. For most of the services here, we use what we call an independent model, independent rate buildup. For the services that you see in phase one, like behavioral health, like the LTSS, these home and community-based services, there is typically no data unless a state requires providers to give their costs. So you actually have to kind of make your data through cost surveys, which is what we did with the providers. We went and asked them what their costs are, which is actually great in Alaska because you don't want to piggyback off of other costs seen in the rest of the country. But we essentially take those costs that the providers give us, and we build up a rate based on those costs. So we understand what it takes to deliver these services. You're going to need practitioner time. There's administrative overhead. There's travel components. There's different kinds of indirect costs. We capture those things: wages, staffing ratios, employee benefits, and then we put them together into rate models that will tell you on a cost-based rate what it would cost for a provider to deliver a quality service with all the requirements that a service involves. And just really one last thing I want to stress before we actually get to the results of our recommendations is noting that actual costs are extremely important in Alaska to understand, because the cost profile for delivering services is really unlike any other state in the country. So we captured those costs through our survey, through different cost reports for FQHCs, and we really benchmarked them to other public data that was available, and that really drove the benchmarks around what we thought services should cost. All right, so I will now just kind of transition into going into our particular findings and recommendations for each of these programmatic areas, and I'll start with behavioral health. Really three key findings in behavioral health. The first is that one of the things that we saw is that overall service reimbursement, we are recommending some overall sort of rate increases, but the biggest issue that we saw is that service reimbursement is misaligned. Many services have adequate reimbursement right now. Many services are actually probably paid more than our benchmarks tell us is needed, but some are significantly lower. The actual cost is significantly lower than the service. So a key recommendation for us is that the state in behavioral health needs rate equity or rate rebalancing. There's different things you can call it, but it's not necessarily that you need an infusion of lots more money. Before the dollars that go into the service, there's a need to appropriately calibrate the service so that you're paying appropriately. Otherwise, you're providing incentives to over-deliver a certain service and under-deliver others based on how those rates look. A second key point was around indirect costs. What we saw in terms of overhead and what we call program support, everything that you can't directly bill for but is necessary to provide the service, that was disproportionately high. So we saw this is true for LTSS as well as behavioral health. For every dollar you're spending on behavioral health, about 40 cents of it goes to indirect costs, and that's really higher than anything we see in the rest of the country. And really kind of the third piece, with sort of lack of historical standards and kind of historical misalignment, there's not really built into the system any way to sort of drive efficiency. Essentially, the state is paying for the cost of services, and those costs go up every year.
Representative Stapp, and then more for Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justin, to the Chair. Thanks for being here, folks. Can you elaborate maybe a little bit on point number two regarding basically the delivery of the services being so high? So first question would be, how does that 40 cents on the dollar compare to other jurisdictions that you've looked at? And the second question is this just all an administrative cost that the service, the providers themselves are using to, say, do these billables through the chair?
Mr. Jones.
Through the chair to Representative Staff. Representative Stapp. These indirect costs reflect really two sort of cost buckets. One of them is administrative overhead. The other is what we're calling program support costs. So that might be another worker who's assisting in delivering the services but can't bill for it themselves, but they need to be included in the cost. We're seeing that in Alaska, it's higher than what we see in other jurisdictions. I would say 30% of the cost would be high and would be very high in most other jurisdictions. Alaska's at 40%. We will usually see probably between 20 and 30%. I don't have a lot of very strong theories on what's driving that. There are higher personnel costs generally in Alaska, but the higher costs are direct care costs as well as these indirect care costs. So we calculate these indirect costs as a percentage of the direct care costs. And if you have really high direct care costs, you could also have really high indirect care costs without it being disproportionately high relative to the direct costs. I don't know if that was extremely clear, but what we're seeing is indirect costs are making up 40% of the whole rate, and that's disproportionately high. It's usually between 20 and 30%, including both overhead and program support.
I have a follow-up, Mr. Kutcher.
Follow-up, Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Kutcher, Justin, through the chair. It makes sense to me, but I think in layman terms, basically, there's been spending 40 cents on the dollar in basically administrative costs, right, which I think is very odd. On the health side, the federal government requires insurance companies to spend 15%, right? But in all of your research, was this, you mentioned personnel, additional personnel for the service, and costs like admin, billing, medical, that type of stuff, right? Were you able to determine whether or not the additional personnel, non-billable personnel utilized in the direct care process was more of a driver, or was it straight up the paperwork through the chair?
Mr. Jones.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp. One of the ways that we do our cost survey in order to make it manageable for all the providers, because it is a huge undertaking to report all these costs, we capture broadly the cost categories and indirect costs. But say if we're looking at administrative personnel, we don't ask questions about who exactly is in what roles and what their salaries are. So we capture it at a pretty high level. So we could tell you what's driving the indirect care costs to the extent that we could tell you whether it's broadly administrative personnel or this program support personnel category or transportation or IT. But beyond sort of appropriately bucketing them, we can't tell you if there's a sort of a particular driver of say, for instance, broadband being more expensive in certain parts of Alaska.
Thanks.
Sure.
Representative Moore.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Thanks for being here. Through the chair, I just was going to go back to slide 10. I was curious about the provider costs survey. What percentage of the providers responded to you guys on that?
It was different for each program. Generally, we're aiming at about 30% response rate. I might have to pass it to my colleagues for the exact number here. So I'll pass it to Claire.
Claire Payne, Behavioral Health Lead, Guidehouse. Through the chair, Representative Moore. It definitely varied depending on the service, one of those work streams that we commented on, right? So behavioral health, how we looked at it specifically, is you look at the sheer number of providers. So if you count providers, right, as well as the actual total Medicaid dollars that they deliver. Because, you know, you could have 100 providers that maybe only do a little bit of Medicaid, and so they don't have the same labor force. On the behavioral health side, it was about 60% of the Medicaid dollars were responded to in the survey. We usually, based on a company called Qualtrics, and they're actually the one who does a lot of the surveys in the country, they think a representative sample is about 35%. So you're almost double that. And I believe our other providers were similar. FQHC, their federally qualified health centers, was quite a bit different because it's a much smaller pool of providers.
Okay, follow-up?
Yes, follow-up. Representative Moore.
And the providers that did report costs, were those validated?
Through the chair to Representative Moore, Coy Jones. We didn't validate those in the sense we do make a distinction between a cost report, which is usually audited and certified, and a cost survey, which for the sake of time and expediency to get real-time data that's not years old, we don't look at audited financials and back up the dollars. So there is a bit of an understanding that you're kind of trading accuracy for expediency on this point. I do want to go back a little bit to the survey piece because we had a lot of surveys for a lot of different services. But one example where we had low response rates, but we're not concerned, is air ambulance. There are a lot of air ambulance providers. Some are much bigger than others. So we had a very poor response rate from the perspective of number of providers. You know, it's probably four of all the different providers. But among those providers, we captured about 90% of the volume. And so I think each of those programs sort of tells the story. But generally, we were comfortable with the feedback that we got through the survey.
Okay. So to be clear on that question, no, they were not validated.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we have Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. This is a question around, you were talking about 30% would be considered, that is 30% of the costs over the indirect costs would be considered high of the overhead, and that we were looking at 40% direct costs. And I bring this up because I wonder if there was consideration around what I heard from behavioral health providers that 40% of their time was spent doing paperwork to allow them to get reimbursed. And I want to ask you this in the context of the state of Alaska as opposed to, I think it was Wyoming. There are a few other states that are using a federal form instead of whatever Alaska is using, and I don't know all the details, so forgive me for not giving you detailed question here, but I want to know what you have, based on your experience of looking at other states, and how much this should be considered, that is, what we are putting out that must be filled out by our providers, and whether or not that plays a big role in this cost differential.
Mr. Jones.
Through the chair to Through the chair to Representative Galvin. I do want to clarify, when I say 40%, that's total indirect costs. So it's not all, that's not all overhead. A lot of, especially in the case of behavioral health, a lot of that is program support costs. So that's the cost of transportation, for example. It's not admin. Like, you have to do some, you have to spend that money to provide the service, but you can't bill for it. And so just really want to note that. In the case of these services, in these particular services, you have a fee-for-service structure in Alaska. That's going to require a certain level of reporting and documentation to be able to, for all the fraud, you know, considerations that I think everyone is aware of, you need that basic documentation to be able to make the claim and really tie it back to a service delivered. In some cases, you can leverage federal processes, but for most of these services, behavioral health, LTSS, the transportation pieces, there's not a standardized kind of federal system that we think would, you know, streamline this process. There are potentially some rules, some administrative rules in the state that could be changed. We didn't really know, you know, we didn't note some many of those. That wasn't really a focal point of our study, but yes, there are some reforms going on in behavioral health right now that would lead to, say, CCBHCs, clinically certified behavioral health centers. Part of that payment methodology, which, you know, Alaska's moving to, would address some of this administrative overhead, because you pay for it through what's kind of an episode that cuts down on a lot of this documentation. It has its own challenges, but that's a potential improvement, and we did look at those sorts of things.
Following up on Representative Galvin's question, there's an existing bill now, Senate Bill 45, short title Medicaid Mental Health Parity, relating to parity in mental health and substance use disorder coverage in the state medical assistance program. We all have scores and scores of meetings. It's hard to remember each one, but these were behavioral health providers, top level in the state, who came and talked about the burden of paperwork that they have that other types of physical health care providers don't, I guess, relating to parity. And I think that's sort of what Representative Galvin is getting to. I don't know if you've heard this sort of complaint around the country. The key word is parity.
To Representative Josephson. Sorry. I'm familiar with the parity issue. We didn't see anything strictly related to the parity issue. Many of these services that we're studying, there really is no sort of equivalent to commercial health care where parity is an issue. As to the complaint about really high burdens of documentation, we hear that everywhere. Not to diminish the reality and truth of it, but the, you know, we hear it from medical providers as well as behavioral health providers. Behavioral health providers are a little newer to the world of medical claiming. Like, there's sort of latecomers into the Medicaid program, unlike hospitals and other folks who have been doing this for decades and decades. There is a learning curve to making claiming more efficient, and it probably is more difficult for behavioral health providers than established medical providers. And let me pass over some additional comments to my colleague.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. So just another way that we account for that in the methodology that we were kind of getting at, right, why we spent so much time trying to tell you all the different ways that we actually look at a rate. We don't just want to take it and move it forward based on inflation, right, because then you're just taking a system that's already gotten out of sync and you're just perpetuating that, right? So we look at all these very nuanced pieces in that methodology. One of those is what we call a billable time adjuster or productivity adjuster, right? And we see that traditionally a lot higher in the behavioral health space for this document and this record keeping, right? If you're in a therapy session, as an example, that therapist is supposed to have a care plan. They're supposed to document. They're supposed to take notes on what's supposed to happen next in your follow-up, right? That does take a lot of time. And so when you actually go and look at the rate models that we've developed in the appendix of the report, you're going to see that little adjuster, and you're going to see that it's substantially lower, which counterintuitive, but increases the reimbursement to account for that quote-unquote downtime, right? So we did try to address that very specifically, and as my colleague Coy Jones mentioned here, it is traditionally higher in behavioral health, and so you'll notice that difference.
For the record, that was Claire Payne.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think we're going to go on without objection to Representative Hannon, then Bynum. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Before I go back to the question I was going to ask, my understanding when a meeting learning about parity for behavioral health services, it was more described that as opposed to I went to see my doctor and the doctor decides I'm depressed and can prescribe to me at that moment a medication and I can start a treatment course and in 6 weeks evaluate whether it's being effective or not, that our therapist under behavioral health frequently has to say, you need to go to a medical provider, and then you get a script, and then you go back to your doctor, who then has you come back to see me. So they're getting this, it's two or three sessions before they have something to bill for, and that's where the bulk of this extra time for the behavioral health treatment, as opposed to the medical provider, can step right in, get you a script, and then say, follow-ups in 6 weeks. Is that accounted for in some of this indirect cost?
Ms. Payne.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hannon. Not specifically, right? Because we're actually more so trying to come up with, okay, I'm a patient. I go see my therapist. They see me for 30 minutes. I get a bill for that 30 minutes, right? The downtime of maybe they have to follow up with your insurance or, again, extended record keeping, note keeping, maybe they have to chase you down for your follow-up, that would be accounted for in this kind of down, lost, non-billable time. The medical component with the parity rule, though, is where it gets a little nuanced, and I think we'd have to follow up and look at it specifically so I don't misquote it.
Okay. And then can I return to indirect costs?
Yes, on Representative Hannon on indirect
thank
costs.
You, Chair Josephson. Although you're saying in bullet two that we're spending more, we're at 40 cents on the dollar as opposed to 25 or 30, when you talked just one element of medical transportation, and so much of it being non-billable, but I can think of a million circumstances where, you know, the vernacular in Alaska, were you able to transport them on a seat fare, or did you have to charter the plane? Mm-hmm. Two big different costs. Neither of them would seem to be reimbursable because they're not ambulance costs or paratransit. So when you're looking at that and saying we're 40 cents on every dollar, you're not concluding that they're invalid charges, it's just that they are higher. So it's not just our cost of utilities, it's just that in some of these broad categories, we have such bizarre compared to anywhere else that the option in Wyoming is, you know, a 50-mile drive or a 200-mile drive, but for us, it literally is it a chartered flight, is it a seat fare, is there a ferry alternate, is it a private transport on a snow machine?
Mr. Jones.
Through the chair, Representative Hannah. That's right. We note that they're high. However, we didn't, in our benchmarking, we didn't say they should not be so high. We took them, we understand the costs are higher in Alaska. And so for the most part, our rates do reflect those high indirect costs. So there isn't any kind of prescription on what those indirect costs should be.
Okay, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, and through the chair, thank you for being here today. Obviously, the amount of time we have here today is not going to cover the scope and depth of what you guys actually do, running a $3.8 billion program in the state of Alaska, $1 billion worth of UGF. So when we talk about that kind of money, you guys are talking about trying to find little cost savings measures and being a little more efficient in how we do business. That can equate to hundreds of millions of dollars. So I was just wanting to have a better understanding of when we start talking about these programs. We understand in Alaska that we have Medicaid expansion, and as part of expansion, we get a 90%, that's a 10 to 90% cost share on that. And then under standard Medicaid, that's, I think, about a 50-50. It's a little less than 50-50. When we're talking about the data, do we track the cost associated with those different user groups? And, for example, we specifically have behavioral health here. Do we know, based on those user groups, who's using these services?
Through the chair to Representative Bynum, we do know in the claims, for instance, what populations are using using each of the different services, and like in the case of Alaska Native populations, whether the rate is paid for through very high levels of FMAP, federal share, or state share. So we can tell you program by program how the state dollars are being spent versus additional federal dollars.
Yep. Follow up?
Representative Bynum.
So with that being said, are you tailoring your data and research to target the best return for those higher cost share the ones where we have the 50-50, for example, expenses, because those are the ones that's really driving up our actual spend. And that isn't to say we shouldn't be very frugal and very wise with every dollar we get, including federal dollars, but from a targeted perspective, I would assume that, you know, we want to be able to target where are we getting the best value and return so that we can either save the state of Alaska money or we can provide better services to Alaskans.
Through the chair to Representative Bynum. Yes, we do that in the report. We do note where we do note where different services, like significant state investment here, would get a larger ROI. That's very important in the case of transportation, where some of the most significant expenses are incurred in rural and frontier areas, where the federal dollar goes extremely far relative to the state spend. So you'll see in our fiscal impact, even with a relatively small investment in state dollars, you could get as much as $4 for every dollar that you spend. Now that's not true of every program, and you'll see when we look at the fiscal impact of federal versus state that dollars go further with some programs than others.
One more question.
One more question, and then we're going to actually get to the results.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Co-Chair Josephson. When we talk about behavioral health, obviously your department's in front of us, but we have another element within the state, the Mental Health Trust. What kind of coordination are we seeing between your department and the Mental Health Trust to make sure that we're leveraging all of our resources to get to healthy Alaskans, basically?
So they're not a department as much as a vendor, but yeah. DC Ritchie?
Hey. Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Bynum, for the record, this is Emily Ritchie, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. We do coordinate with the Alaska Mental Health Trust. We do work together in the development of different budget scenarios. We present to the board regularly, and one of the areas you'll see us focus on, excuse me, both this year and in upcoming years, is making sure that we're really leveraging dollars between both entities to go as far as possible, because some of the dollars that the state can use to support behavioral health services have limitations. And some of the dollars the trust has access to may have more flexibilities. So we're really trying to be strategic in thinking about how we can weave those together to meet the needs that we have.
Thank you.
Okay, slide 13.
Coy Jones again for the record. We're now on the results side of things, so slide 13. So looking at behavioral health, given the findings that we just walked through, one of our key recommendations is this methodology transition and rate recalibration. So we're recommending that the DOH adopt the methodologies that go into our independent rate buildup to really identify rates that are more appropriate and align more closely with the actual costs of delivering particular services. Now, the implication of adopting that methodology transition is that there will have to be some recalibration of rates. Some rates for services will go up significantly. Some might decrease significantly. But that's a part of this rebalancing that we're talking about. That's why we have the second recommendation under rates, which is hold harmless. When you do that rebalancing, it increases a lot of volatility for providers. It's not a complete wash where, for a single provider, some of their rates may go up, some of their rates may go down. It all balances out. But that's not always the case. For some providers, they're focusing on the rate that's going down rather than the rate that's going up. And so you can put somebody out of business easily if you don't do it wisely. So we're recommending having a risk corridor where you're essentially leaving rates that would lower, as leaving them as they are until kind of there's a natural point at which rate increases would happen. Finally, there's under rates, there's a broader level of rate rebalancing. I'm going to bring it up, happy to answer questions on it, but there's a unique feature of Alaska's system called the UPL, and it's a ceiling for certain services that you can't pay higher than what Medicare pays. And so we put some recommendations in there in terms of in the report around how to address that issue around the clinic UPL demonstration. Looking at other sort of other pieces of the reimbursement structure, behavioral health does not adjust; those rates are not adjusted geographically, and we are proposing a framework to have slightly different rates depending on where services are delivered. We believe this is pretty feasible because it already exists in the LTSS side in home and community-based services, and we're recommending something similar for implementation with behavioral health. Kind of going back to the indirect costs, one of the things that's unclear about how services are designed and described right now is whether the rates are really designed to cover transportation and staff transportation. So one of our recommendations is to include a specific add-on in certain rates so that is addressed more clearly. Some of the more complex services around SUD for adolescents versus adults, we did make some specific recommendations to the state to review those service definitions to confirm whether or not the state is paying for the type of service that it wants, and to work with providers to review those service definitions. And then we're also recommending updates to crisis services. So the state is in the process now of sort of redesigning its crisis service array, and we've included some recommendations on what rates would be appropriate for those new services. Finally, just looking at sort of state operations, how these rates get implemented and monitored over time, we are recommending that the state put together a cost reporting system, which would require sort of annual reporting from providers. There are two big reasons for that. One is to understand these indirect costs. Even though we've sort of taken them at face value, there is an argument to be made as to whether they should be lower. But the data is really not there to kind of track what's going on, what goes on with the costs. And by putting in a cost reporting system, the state will have better information to understand the nature of the indirect costs and potentially establish additional reimbursement features that incentivize efficiencies. That could ultimately be to the benefit of both the payer and regulator as well as the provider. Another piece is this clinic UPL issue. If you have cost reporting, you don't have to set the ceiling at the Medicare rate. You can set it at actual costs. And so if Alaska ever wants to pay more beyond the ceiling or rebalance those rates that fall under the clinic UPL, cost reporting really facilitates that. And then finally, we made an administrative recommendation that the state, using the methodology that we're recommending, can more easily update rates administratively every year by just essentially putting kind of key inflation factors on things like wages and other indirect costs.
So the CMS prohibition on exceeding the UPL can be dispensed with if you do cost reporting?
You have a new measuring stick, so the requirement doesn't go away, but the nature of how the upper payment limit is decided changes. So instead of basing the ceiling on the equivalent Medicare rate, you base it on the actual costs incurred by providers. And so if those costs are higher than Medicare would pay, you can still pay up to those costs. But it requires actually having data on what providers pay, and what it costs providers.
Okay. All right. Slide 14.
Okay. So getting to the dollars here. So what we've described is we have sort of line item estimates of what it would take to implement these pieces. So the first recommendation, which is simply to adopt the new methodology and the rates that correspond to it, that would cost an additional $4.1 million, on the state side, an additional total investment of $13 million. That's not all that high, given behavioral health. I don't want to diminish the point, but given behavioral health spending now, relatively, that's not a high amount. And that's because in this basic recommendation, higher rates are being offset to some extent by rates that would decrease. Now, of course, keeping in mind the hold harmless, if you're not going to lower rates for those services that where we would otherwise see rates go down, it would basically be an additional $1.6 million to keep rates that would otherwise lower where they are now. And so that's recommendation two. The geographic differentials would likely result in I'm just mostly reading kind of the general fund here. That would be an additional $1.3 million to kind of cover the costs for the more expensive regions of the state. The behavioral health cost reporting, we've noted that depending on kind of how the state implements that would be an additional $150,000 to $225,000 in state spend. We've not put a price tag on the rate rebalancing because it very much depends on how the state wants to address that. For crisis services, we have an additional $280,000+, and then we anticipate a small need for additional resources to do the administrative rate review. So collectively, if you implemented, I understand that the Department of Health is looking at a phased implementation of this. The overall cost that we're kind of looking at is about $7.2 to $7.5 million in general fund for an overall investment, including federal dollars of roughly $21 million for behavioral health.
Mr. Jones, how long is the hold harmless period?
That you
would recommend.
To the chair, 2 years is usually a good hold harmless period. If it's much shorter, it doesn't help. If it's much longer, it also doesn't help. It is designed to be temporary to prepare providers for changes. So I would say 2 to 3 years would be really optimal.
And how do you incorporate inflation into these recommendations?
This is one I'll pass over to my colleague,
Ms. Payne.
Yeah, Claire Payne, director with Guidehouse, through the chair. So in inflation, what we did, because data already gets old, right? So your favorite thing about data is no matter what, the next day it's already old, right? So our base recommendations already included a small amount of inflation because the data set we use was already a year behind. So we wanted to get it to 7/1/2025 was the implementation date. We did not build in additional inflation, knowing that you have in your regulations that should come into effect at July 1st of every year. So you would have to apply additional inflation based on your regulations.
Okay. All right. Any other question from the committee? These are, of the four components, these are the furthest along in terms of completion. Is that right? Or publication, maybe is a better word. Your work on behavioral health recommendations is done.
Yes.
Okay. DC Ritchie, could I ask you a question, please? Ms. Ritchie, what is the state's goal for, first of all, I think you've said that, or maybe you haven't, these are merely recommendations in the department's eyes. I assume they're important, but there may be other factors for you. When is it that you would anticipate implementing these changes?
Through the chair, to the chair, Representative Josephson, for the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. We are working to implement these recommendations in probably two different phases, and we are promulgating regulations right now to begin implementing the rate rebalancing and the hold harmless combined. Again, we have the $10 million temporary increment in the Medicaid component, and I believe the supplemental that was just released, the updated supplemental, will extend that into FY27, giving us time to promulgate the regulations to begin implementing that. We will also look at the same time at building out the geographic differences and the crisis services. We are thinking about the best way to approach establishing a system for cost reporting. Ultimately, that is going to be important as Medicare continues to put pressure, not just on the behavioral health system, but the rest of the Alaska system. That's something that I think this committee will hear more about in future years. But the requirement to have annual cost reporting is significant to both the provider and to the state. And so if this is something we move forward with, we hear very loudly the concerns about behavioral health providers related to administrative requirements and burden. We don't want to add to that, but we also can't get around the Medicare limit to a limit that reflects costs until we find a way to collect that data. So we're not sure quite what that looks like yet.
Okay. Thank you. All right. I think we're done with slide 14. We'll go to long-term services, slide 16.
Sure. So the grooves have been established, I think, with behavioral health. For LTSS, there's somewhat similar findings here. We didn't see the same need for rebalancing for LTSS services that we did for behavioral health. For the most part, the state has kept up pretty well with costs, with one important exception, which is personal care services. We did see a need for about 32% increase in rates. That is a significant part of the service array. And so you will see in the fiscal impact, just given the expenditures on LTSS generally, that those lead to some significant dollars, even though they're not a high proportion of current spending. But when you take out the personal care, you can see that generally rates for LTSS have kept pace. We did note with other findings with the geographic rate differentials. Those are in place for these services, but they depend on a framework that's over 20 years old. So we did recommend a new way to do geographic differentials. The same issue in indirect costs. We found, almost coincidentally, about 40 cents to every dollar for LTSS services was going to indirect costs.
Care services, these are there are various acronyms, and they sort of overlap, like a PCA.
That's right. Yeah, personal care aide who comes into your home helps with tasks and basic home-based services.
You're finding that in Alaska, our cohort is paid 32% less than you would recommend? Is that what you said?
Rates would need to be 32% higher for those services, roughly, to cover the costs.
Right. So the rates, which is the total package, might reflect some other number as a wage increase, but there's some connection, I'm sure, between the rate and the wage. Is that a fair statement?
Correct, yeah. The wages are the driver of costs.
Okay. Steer the train. Take us where you want to go.
Okay, so we're recommending the same methodology and rate recalibration that we did for behavioral health, and then as well as hold harmless. There's a very small amount of services that that would otherwise go down with adopting our recommendations. We're recommending updates to the geographic adjustment, some tiered service recommendations for better for better capturing acuity differences in needs between individuals, and then around some administrative fees for certain services known as the organized healthcare delivery system. As with behavioral health, we're also recommending a new cost reporting system. That's to track indirect costs, but also in the case of these types of services, there's new rules coming down from CMS called the Access Rule, which actually mandates a ceiling on indirect costs that you should pay for things like personal care. And a state has to demonstrate that its providers are not paying more for indirect costs. And if you don't collect that cost data, you can't be compliant with the federal regulations. And then additional administrative rate updates, as with behavioral health. And just going back to, you know, looking at the opportunities for drawing higher federal share, LTSS is one of those areas where the federal piece is about 50-50. And so we do recommend looking to tribal providers and gauging willingness to invest in more in providing these services.
So where we see 100% opportunities to reclaim, I think is the word, that is not true, and we're very good at that now in Alaska. That's not true for LTSS.
Right. It's largely non-tribal providers delivering those services, and it's drawing the 50-50 match.
Got it. Okay, so here we go, slide 18.
All right, so this is really the fiscal impact. You see just given the size of this program and really kind of funding personal care and a few to the benchmark rate along with a few other rates, there is a fairly hefty price tag, even though it's not a massive proportion of the overall kind of spending currently, but that's the biggest piece. I do want to note there is a correction on the on the bottom. If you would switch the columns, we have the state, we have the general fund and the federal and the total in the wrong columns there. But we break out the hold harmless, the geographic differentials, our rate tiering recommendations, and so the total price tag on the state side would be 24 to around $30 million to cover all of those recommendations. And again, this is an area where DOH is looking at a phased approach, is our understanding.
Okay, well, let's go to FQHCs.
Okay, As Deputy Commissioner Ricci sort of noted early on, this was a narrower scope for FQHCs. It really came down to the small number of FQHCs who have not moved to the APM rate. There are about four now that are still on the PPS rate. So the goal of this the goal of these recommendations were really to establish a pathway for those who are still in the PPS to do what we're calling a one-time catch-up change in scope. To look at current costs of those rates and establish a pathway and recommendations for future increases. Not future increases, but future changes in scope. So the catch-up change in scope, we did an analysis to look at what it would cost so both providers and the state would understand kind of what the potential fiscal implications are, even though we expect that really only probably one or two providers would want to do that PPS rather than move to an APM. And then in order to support that, we recommended some technical assistance to provide to those providers who are interested, and then, again, having that policy and process moving forward that allows the providers to update their PPS rates. That was short and sweet, but happy to take any questions.
All right, let's go to 22.
Yep. So on general fund expenditures, we see maximally if all the providers wanted to go in that direction with a PPS, it would be up to $1.5 million, if a smaller number, $800,000. This is one where the general matching rate is about 75% FMAP. So you see that for $1.5 million, the total would be about $5.3 million investment.
And finally, transportation.
Okay, this is this area. The report has not been fully released yet. I can basically offer you preliminary pieces. The The big issue is that the ambulance and lodging rates have not been increased in many, many years. So we are recommending that those rates be, in aggregate, brought up to what is equivalent to about 125% of Medicare. And so that we've calculated how that would work in air transportation as well as ground transportation. Because costs are lower, because the rates are lower right now, we are seeing ambulance staffing becoming a more significant issue, getting those staff in place. And then there are administrative issues that that prevent people from getting the lodging that they need. And so we've made recommendations around there. And then especially around out-of-state lodging and transportation and meals, we've made some, for those traveling to Seattle, for example, we've made some recommendations that would improve those policies.
Question from Representative Staff for Mr. Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Richard Joseph, through the chair to Mr. Jones. Mr. Jones, I assume the Medicaid rate reimbursement is still subject to the UPL. Is that correct, through the chair?
I'm sorry, could you restate that?
I assume the air ambulance rate reimbursement is still subject to UPL, correct, through the chair?
That is correct. The UPL is different for transportation than clinic, and so it's up to average commercial rates. So in Alaska, this has not hit a ceiling because the ceiling is so much higher.
Yeah, follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Staff for Mr. Coy. Yeah. Mr. Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair, Mr. Jones. Do you know how far the rate is off of the upper payment limit, through the chair?
Mr. Jones.
We don't know because that would involve commercial rate negotiation, proprietary data between commercial insurers and the providers. So we don't have that data available.
Another follow-up, Mr.
Yes, follow-up. Rep. Staff.
Yeah, thank you. Air ambulance, obviously, pretty big deal in Alaska, so we want to make sure we kind of drive down this point. What is this a product? So the primary company here, Guardian Flight, has been bought and sold many times in the last few years. So I'm curious if some of the challenges that they have, as opposed to other carriers like LifeMed, have been reflected so far in what you've been finding, through the chair.
Mr. Jones.
I think what we've found is really applies to most of the providers. I don't think our findings are unique to Guardian. Generally, Medicare and Medicaid both pay significantly lower than commercial rates. So our recommendations really reflect just these public insurance programs paying more of their share.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
What I'm hearing from the service providers, pilots, Guardian, et cetera, is that they are not reimbursed for costs of there's a modifier. Basically, as Representative Galvin said, when they're en route and they have no patient with them, and that's a cost, and that cost isn't built into their current reimbursement rate. Combined with that, they note that there have been, I think they used the number 160 flights that were canceled, not weather-related, in the span of a year, where they just couldn't provide the service anymore. And that sounds spooky to me. I don't know if you had any conversations like that with providers.
To the chair, we heard similar feedback from the providers. Again, that's a constraint in the nature of the Medicaid program that you can't pay directly for those things, but you can build it. You can build in your rates an understanding that there is non-billable time and resources that have to be covered.
Okay. All right, let's go to slide 20. If you're done with 25, we'll go to 26. Only if you're done.
Sure. Yeah. Just really noting that the big issues are increasing rates here for the ambulance providers, and there are a few policy recommendations we make, and then on the partnerships, really just noting a recommendation for a statewide brokerage, which could have some really substantial positive effects for non-emergency medical transportation. And if you look at the fiscal impact. Yep. For these pieces on slide 26, really again just noting the issues around drawing higher federal share with these ambulance rate increases, for instance, for example, we're looking at additional state expenditures of 2.3 to 2.4 million, which would draw an additional 16 million total. And so essentially what that boils down to is for every dollar that you put into these rate increases, you get four additional dollars from the federal government, which, and again, this targets areas of particular need in the state because this really disproportionately positively impacts rural and frontier travel heavily on the air ambulance side as well as the ground ambulance. Rate increases you'll see for lodging, it's a very similar picture. The need for lodging, of course, is higher for folks coming into Anchorage from rural and frontier areas. We've made some estimates around even potential savings for a public transportation partnership or the use of a brokerage. It depends on implementation as to whether it's going to be an increase or yield potential savings.
Okay, I think the term that the industry uses is unloaded versus loaded planes, I think is what...
That's correct, yeah.
Actually, let me go to committee member questions. We'll go start with Representative Stapp, then Hannon, then Bynum.
Yeah, thank you, Coach, Justin, through the chair, to Mr. Jones. A couple of just housekeeping items, I guess, regarding some of the terminology. You have a slide here, prior authorization fee increase. Can you elaborate? I know what prior auth is, but what do you mean by fee increase through the chair?
Right, the... through the chair to Representative Stapp. Tribal TMOs that actually serve as a kind of broker arranging transportation. In order to go through the prior authorization process, they charge a fee. Essentially, the fee was set many years ago and doesn't reflect all the – because transportation needs change pretty regularly, sometimes it can be administratively complex. So we recommended increasing the fee for working the prior authorization system.
Fault, Mr. Kutcher.
Follow-up. Representative Stapp from Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Kutcher. To Mr. Jones. Also, the thought – this notion of brokerage – and government-to-government partnerships. What do you mean by that, through the chair?
Mr. Jones.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp. So we call them government-to-government partnerships because some of the elements of the brokerage happen through these TMOs. So it's not technically a brokerage. It's a government-to-government agreement. But that's not going to cover all the travel needs. So we are looking at a statewide broker in which the tribes are not involved. It doesn't involve necessarily tribal travel. So among the current TMOs and the brokerage, that would be sort of a larger statewide structure.
Fault, Mr. Kutcher.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Justin. Okay. Statewide broker as in the state of Alaska? Like, I don't know of any third-party vendors that would do that. So is it suggesting that we would do that instead of how the tribal entities already do that themselves through the chair?
Mr. Jones.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp. So for non-tribal Medicaid members, you would be bringing in a transportation broker that is arranging the travel needs for the non-tribal population. So there are TMOs for the tribal populations who do this arrangement for tribal populations, but there is no broker at this point in time. And that could be a very helpful thing for Alaska. But it would not be the state doing the arranging.
Yeah, gotcha. Thanks.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Let me go one step more ignorant on the brokerage. You mean like a travel office, a travel agency?
Mr. Jones.
Through the chair to Representative Hannon. That's exactly what I mean.
Okay.
Travel broker.
Follow-up.
On seasonal lodging rates. So currently, we have no variation in the rate. So if we're – and I'm just going to pull this out of the air. If it's $100 for accommodation, it's whether it's peak travel season in June where our hotel rates double overnight on May 1st, or whether it's the dead of winter. Okay.
That is correct. We're recommending seasonal differences and increases generally. So even if you don't do a seasonal increase, there needs to be a general increase in the current rate.
Thank you.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the chair, I got to tell you, I was really excited to see this last slide because we went through all of this, and there were actually two line items where we said we actually save money. So I was pretty excited to see that. But overall, when I look through here, I see that we have an estimated $43 million of additional recommendations, and I understand that when we're increasing these rates, we're actually helping the folks that are providing these services. But and with an additional $110 million of federal match that would be associated with it. So I think that's overall good that the providers are getting the reimbursement rates that are necessary to provide the services that we're asking for. But frequently I sit in my office and I have folks that come in and they ask us to look at this. Things that they're actually asking us quite a bit is to, hey, we need to really look at this because there are many areas where we can move the continuum care to the left. So we can provide care sooner, better care, and we save money in the long term. I'm just trying to get a better understanding of the presentation I just saw here today that is actually going to accomplish that. And so nothing in here from your evaluation about the rates really gives a recommendation or reflection of saying, now that we've done this, we can actually save money by moving continuum care to the left. All I just see is an additional $43 million to spend to be able to provide care. So I was just trying to hope that maybe you can address that a little bit, if it's possible. Maybe that's not something you guys evaluated at all. The department might be able to talk a little bit about it, but I appreciate any kind of feedback on that. Thank you.
D.C. Ritchie.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Bynum, for the record, this is Emily Ritchie with the Department of Health. This study was really focused on really looking at the rates, the underlying rate methodology, and the buildups, right? And does that produce the outcomes that we want? And again, this was focused on these specific work streams. As I said at the very beginning, there's no expectation from the department that these are implemented all at once or potentially even ever, depending, again, on the policy considerations and the fiscal situation that we face as a state. But many of these questions we have been asked by providers or stakeholders or constituents since we started in 2022, and I think they were asked prior to that. And so this starts to give a little bit of shape to what the answers to what some of those questions may mean and the magnitude of that. I agree that that has to also, any consideration in this has to also align with what we want to see in the outcome of the system, which is more of a, I think, an emphasis on prevention, more of an emphasis on better aligning our services to meet the risks and the acuity of the population that we serve. I don't think our healthcare system does a great job of doing that right now, and I don't know that our health insurance systems, any of them, whether it's Medicaid or any other type of insurer, does that either. That is something that will be a focus area for the department in the next several years, and we have some ideas on, you know, where we can start and what we can look at. Those are not included in these studies.
Perfect. Thank you. One follow-up?
Yes, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the chair. I've heard quite a bit here recently. One of our senators talked quite a bit about FMAP and the fight that they've underwent to get a change in that, basically trying to get a 20 or 30-70 type split instead of the 50-50 split that we have. Through all your evaluations, was there any consideration put in place to say what the overall impact would be for us if there was success from our congressional delegation to get that FMAP changed?
D.C. Ritchie.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum. Again, that was not part of the request to Guidehouse as part of the rate methodology study. We have been closely watching that, particularly as debate has played out over the last, 13 months now, about Medicaid funding at the national level and the implications of that for Alaska. I can tell you in conversations I think we'll probably have beginning on Wednesday, our what we call our base or our regular FMAP is over 50%. It used to hover at about 50%. It moved up slightly, and we are actually seeing a decrease of about just over 1% beginning in October of next federal fiscal year. And what that translates to for the state is an additional $10.8 million in general fund that we will have to provide looking at federal fiscal year 27. So that's not a direct answer to your question, but it starts to give you a sense of what 1% change in FMAP means in relation to the general fund match at any given year for the Medicaid program. So we track it very closely. And we do try to leverage opportunities to draw down federal match as much as possible. One of the areas you'll see, again, on Wednesday when we talk a little bit about our operating budget, is we are finding ways where we can claim additional federal dollars for IT enhancements or positions associated with that. These are things that other states have been doing. We are also making sure that we are doing that as well on our end.
Thank you.
Representative Hannon, and then I have some questions as well.
Thank you, and Chair Josephson. My question is spurred by Representative Bynum's question about continuum of care, because I guess I came to a different conclusion. So, Ms. Ritchie, correct me if I'm incorrect, but the Guidehouse study on page 16, Mr. Jones noted that the personal care services remains low, and that if we need to increase our rates by maybe up to 32% to reflect actual cost. And my understanding is the whole nature of that is keeping someone with care in their home is at the far left of the continuum of care and saves us money. So even if it is a substantial rate increase of 32%, it saves us money by not putting someone into a hospital or a nursing home with more intensive care and costs. Am I incorrect in that conclusion?
D.C. Ritchie.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, for the record, this is Emily Ritchie. I don't believe you're incorrect. I think the challenge is, and will remain with these types of programs, is how to make sure that those costs result in lower overall cost of care for the individual compared to what they might have received versus additional costs that would not have been otherwise incurred. And I think that's sometimes where we struggle to see some of those investment returns. I would say one area the department will be closely watching is, if there is a desire to move forward with some of the rate recommendations regarding personal care services, we know that that's an area that requires very careful monitoring and crafting to ensure that those services are being used as directed and appropriate. We've had problems in the past with that in Alaska, and I know other states are experiencing that as well. So we need to be very thoughtful before we move forward with that and take into consideration items that are not necessarily considered in the study, but that we would want to make sure are in place from a Medicaid side. I would say the same thing for autism services as well. I have heard consistently concerns from parents or individuals with children that need autism services that are not available in the state. And when I saw the results of the study, that aligned with what I am hearing, that there aren't insufficient autism services, and you notice a large rate recommendation increase for autism services. At the same time, we know that that is an area that can be prone to misuse. And so how do we make sure that we're addressing the need while building in the correct barriers to care for that from the beginning? And so those are all things that we need to be thinking about from the department perspective.
A couple questions for the fine folks from Guidehouse. Are there any connections between your recommendations such that thing A must happen before things B and C happen? As you see reform of the methodology and payment structure?
To Representative Josephson, I think the main dependency is really around the rate increases in the four different areas. Many of the other policy recommendations, they can be many of the kind of the latter recommendations can be implemented independently, but the ones that have the really strong financial impacts, there's a basic adoption of the methodology and the recalibration, and then you can the hold harmless and the other pieces really depend on basically moving forward there.
Mr. Jones, do you see CMS having any concerns with your recommendations? that would result in denial, for example, of estate plan and adjustment, if I've got that right?
I don't see a high probability of that. I don't see that that will be a significant issue. These are accepted methodologies from CMS and, in many cases, preferred methodologies.
And a couple of questions for you, Deputy Commissioner. You said something about the whether changes would be made ever, and I'm having a hard time deciding who's the ultimate decider. Certainly, your department is central. But you noted that it could depend on our state's fiscal position. And I guess what I'm wondering is, if the reimbursement rate is inadequate, is the state allowed for that next year? So I'm not picking on any particular governor, to just let that erode? Or is it a requirement that we, at some point, play ball with some recommendations?
Chair Representative Josephson, the Department of Health works within the budget that it's allocated with, right, including the Medicaid program. And so any sort of changes to the rate or rate methodologies, those go through the appropriations process. It gets a little bit complicated because we have annual inflationary increases that are outlined in regulation, and we have rebasing that occurs perpetually as well, usually in a longer process, so every 4 to 5 years. So you don't want to end up in a position where the funding that's available for the Medicaid component conflicts with the regulatory adjustments that are required. But ultimately, again, the Medicaid program functions within the budget that's allocated from the legislature. And so it would be presumptuous of anyone in the department, whether now or in future years, to put forward substantial rate increases that are not supported through appropriations.
Okay. And then the final question I have is, and I know you've answered this, I'd invite you to do it again, as to the behavioral health portion, but can you give providers who might be listening to any part of this, so transportation, long-term care, a sense of how we're at the beginning of 26, calendar year 26, how you see the department engaging with these recommendations over, say, the next couple of years?
Chair Josephson, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. I think we have a clear vision for behavioral health services. And again, this has been an area where there has been very strong interest and focus by both our team, the legislature, and entities at the federal level since I started. So we know that this is a critical piece that we need to get right. So I think we have a clear plan for that we've talked about in terms of promulgating regulations and leveraging the $10 million increment that is proposed in the supplemental to extend into FY27. I think for the other rate methodology recommendations and considerations, I think we need to have more discussions, again, taking into account the fiscal situation of the state, the realities of the needs that we have that frequently exceed our means to be able to provide for those, and how we prioritize what we are able to invest in. And I don't know what that is today.
But I guess more clearly, what do the regulations require as a timeline on these other three elements of the plan? Do they say you're entitled seven? Is that right? Your regs, the administrative code. At any rate, if I took the time to read through those, would it say January 1, 2028, the department shall do X?
Chair Josephson, I don't know that anything in the study changes what's in existing regulations today. I apologize if I'm not understanding the question correctly.
I'm just. For example, if I'm Guardian Flight Company, for lack of a better term, and I want to know when the department will take action, what can I tell them?
Chair Josephson, I would say we're considering all of the recommendations. Again, we need to evaluate how we implement those in the context of the fiscal situation. And so right now we've identified a path forward with behavioral health rates. I don't know that we have the same clarity on the other rates.
Okay. Representative Bynum, then Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the chair. So as far as your premise for your evaluations, I see that we have these estimated expenditures. And so I'm just trying to also understand that We're making a recommendation for a change in rates that reflects into additional cost. Those rates are to reimburse providers for the services they're providing. Do we take any consideration how does increasing these rates translate into better care? Is the first part of the question. And by increasing these rates, if we do, will this also lead to additional costs that aren't reflected here? Meaning, would certain services potentially be used more frequently because now all of a sudden there might be, say, for example, more providers because we're providing more money to provide that service?
Yeah.
Ms. Payne.
Yeah, Claire Payne, with director with Guidehouse, through the chair, Representative Bynum. So, yeah, I mean, transportation in particular, right? If you actually get people proper access to services, you could see service utilization go up, right? This gets into a little bit of the cost avoidance question you were getting at. So I can get someone to their standard therapies, their standard office visits. Maybe they won't end up in the hospital, right? So it's kind of a chain reaction that it's hard to quantify overall impact 5-10 years in the future. But at surface value, yeah. And you do usually want to get people to their services, access to their services for better care, for the outcomes that you're actually looking for, right?
So as a follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
Thank you, through the chair. So do these current estimates, do they reflect only current services that are being provided under the new rate model and wouldn't take into consideration potential higher uses of services? Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, correct.
Thank you.
This is based on historical utilization where we applied updated rates through the cost. Yeah.
Thank you.
That was Ms. Payne. And this is a comment, looks like, from Deputy Commissioner Ritchie.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum. You know, one area that we're really focusing on and relating, it, especially with behavioral health, is because we hear about challenges in access to care, particularly individuals who may show up at the emergency room and need immediate care. They're not able to get follow-up care in the community as fast as they need. Or you end up with individuals that end up seeking much higher levels of care than they otherwise would because they don't have that community access to care. And so that's one of the reasons that we really focused on the behavioral health rates to start with. So that's an example where you might see an increase in utilization of community providers, but ideally over time, and this is where that challenge comes in, right, you see a decrease in those that are needing acute care, whether that's through inpatient care or other means.
Thank you.
Representative Galvin, and then we're going to close out.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it, Co-Chair Josephson, and through the chair. And I think this might be a question for Deputy Commissioner Ritchie. So I just want to make sure I've understood you clearly. Step one, behavioral health, that's what the department is feeling like it's the right direction to start with in the beginning. My question is, I saw pretty great presentation here helping us to understand that, for example, transportation equals, to me, access to care, and that's another chunk of money. The piece of long-term care, for particularly the 32% for the care providers, that seems very important for access to care as well. And so I guess what I'm asking is if the legislature finds a way to funding, are we appreciating that all of this is important and should be considered? Would the governor consider it, or is the governor already, are we already hearing, is the message I'm getting that there's only one piece of this that we are ready to put forward? I guess that's what I'm asking.
D.C. Ritchie.
To the chair, Representative Galvin, yes, we've been focused on the behavioral health rates. I think about these recommendations, again, I don't want to use the term menu of options because that's not that doesn't translate appropriately, but it really is a series of different considerations you could make. If you're seeing a specific area that needs, where there are gaps and people are not able to get services, so personal care assistance, that might be a conversation to have in the future. You could say, well, this is an area we know if we make changes here, we could see this result. But there's a series of different options that you could combine or take depending on the funding that is available and the need that arises. I asked Guidehouse specifically if they had seen any state that had implemented, you know, recommendations at once or even in their entirety. And they don't, because this is complex and because, again, the every state has different budgetary needs at a different time. But I've been hearing about concerns in some of these areas for a long time. We haven't had any numbers or sense of magnitude to go with those, and then that's what this can help provide to policymakers and appropriators.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you. I appreciate that fully. And I would ask this committee to also remember what we were hearing from last year and the year before, the inordinate amount of care providers who are personal care providers. And so now, to me, this proves it up. They were right. I mean, we heard over and over how they wanted to stay in their job. They loved their job. They're trying their best. I don't know if you remember, it was hours into the evening of testimony about how the personal care attendants cannot continue doing what they want to do because they can't make a living doing it. And this is from all over the state. So I just wanted to raise that up because you had mentioned you're hearing from behavioral health. And I remember very distinctly hearing, and not just on public testimony, but in my office as well, definitely during the interim. So this is an area that I also appreciate is affecting the health and wellness of all of Alaska and that I am hearing from people. So I want to make sure that I've raised their voices since I did hear them. Thank you.
If for example, it happened with, but apparently not enough, with some of these care providers several years ago, would that give the department the confidence that the legislature is serious about making this part of its broader policy within the budget and therefore move to adjust the rates? I mean, I'd have to think about whether those increases, if they were appropriated, would be part of a base budget. If they were, are your rates important to us at that point? These may be questions I could better ask
Representative
Finance.
Chair Josephson, you know, I think we have spent, the department has spent significant time thinking through the implementation of the behavioral health recommendations. We have not spent as much time thinking through the implications of some of the other reports. Given, again, the history of the state, especially related to personal care assistance services, the magnitude of the dollar impact kind of in the import of this issue, we would want to spend considerable time, again, thinking through how it, what would be appropriate and the shape of that, and we are not at that point right now.
All right. I want to thank, this was a good hearing in my mind. We'll take a poll later. I'm teasing. I'd like to thank Deputy Commissioner Ritchie, Mr. Jones, Ms. Payne for their presentations today. That concludes our business for today. Our next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, February 10th at 1:30. At that meeting, we will hear the Alaska Mental Health Trust present its FY27 Governor's Budget Overview. Then beginning at 2:30, we'll hear public testimony at HB 289, the Governor's Supplemental Bill. Please note for that meeting, written testimony may be submitted to the committee at house.finance@akleg.gov. We ask the public to keep their testimony to 2 minutes to ensure everyone has an opportunity to testify. Again, the testimony that you may offer, Alaskans, is on the governor's supplemental bill, House Bill 289. With that, we'll adjourn this meeting at 3:27.